Hello, everyone. We are back. We had a little vacation, but we're continuing now with the Cool Cruel Summers 1988. Darren, how was your little vacation?
My little vacation was very relaxing, actually. I went to Spain, and it was it was locked down, but I still had a great time. It was still good fun. But I'm glad to be getting on with this. I think we're going to knock this on the head now. We're going to do episodes 1 and 2 this week, and then hopefully we've planned at this moment to record 1989 episodes 1 and 2 next weekend. And we get this whole thing over and done with. Mm-hmm. And then we can relax, because it's a hell of a lot of work doing these episodes. We can then decide what we're going to do next for the rest of September and October, which obviously will include some sort of Halloween content.
More than likely. Let's continue. Let's start off with the key moments that Darren has given to us. And it's basically all British key moments.
I think yes. If you look, I think, no.
Okay, but the American moments are awful.
Well, maybe. Okay. Oh, I don't know.
Well, your first key moment is that the first BBC Red Rose Day takes place.
Red Rose? Red Nose?
Red Nose? Why is it called Red Nose? Is that the tipping of the can?
No, it's comic relief. On that particular, this is going to sound really, really mad to Americans now. So every year there's a charity event in the UK called Comic Relief, in which one of the things that people do on that particular day is they wear a red nose, because it's fun, right?
Is it kind of like our Shriners? You know, because we have a charity over here called Shriners, where they wig like the big Pooba hats. And they go into hospitals and make kids laugh for charity.
Yeah, it's kind of that sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? And then the Britain's most unfunny comedians do like a telethon. So I haven't watched it for years, but it happens every year. And the first one took place in 1988. So I thought that was a good key moment for all our British listeners.
Good. 15 mil. That's a pretty good. Is it for kids, right? It's a kids' charity?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
All right. So it was the original Patch Adams.
Exactly.
Our next key moment was Bruce Springsteen's Tunnel of Love tour begins in Worcester. I'll say that 3 times fast. Massachusetts. I was going to say Darren got this wrong. It was supposed to be Worcester, but no, it's actually Worcester.
It's Worcester.
Whatever. Okay. Our next key moment is that here's another British thing. The last broadcast of Crossroads airs on British television. What the fuck is Crossroads?
Crossroads was like a shitty soap opera set in a motel in the Midlands in the UK. And it ran for so many years, and the last episode aired in 1988. It was one of those really cheap soap operas where every time someone shut the door, the whole sets were wobbling and things like that. I put it on there because everybody was relieved when its last episode aired. So.
Because it sucked, or they were just like,
it was terrible. That was fucking awful. Absolutely awful. So it was a relief when that ended.
So next we have, you know, probably the beginning of the end for one person, and that's Mike Tyson crashes his $183,000 Bentley in New York.
On Varick Street. Do you know Varick Street?
No. What's the significance of Varick Street?
I have no idea, but given that you're quite close to it, I thought you might know it.
He was probably picking someone up.
I'm sure.
But it was big news because he was the heavyweight champion of the world, and $183,000 Bentley, he could probably just buy 6 of them, crash one, and didn't really give a shit.
Yeah, it does. He probably didn't mind, did he?
No.
He wasn't bothered.
Now, the next key moment is interesting to me. New licensing laws are introduced. Now, this means that the pubs can stay open all day, right?
That's right. So for many years, we were only allowed to drink between the hours of, I think it was 11 and 2. 11-2 and, sorry, 12-2, I think it was. It was 12-2 and 7-11. Or 7 and 10:30, I think it was. Yeah, you were, the government dictated when you were allowed to drink alcohol. And now we're allowed to open pubs all day. And I think they close at 11 nowadays.
Yeah, here we have something called last call. I'm sure you know about that anyway.
Yeah,
you know, anyone. Yeah. And usually around here, it's 1:30, but some places in upstate New York, it's 2 a.m. So what happens is everyone goes to upstate New York from northern New Jersey, go up there and drink till 2, and then the cops wait by the border for the drugs to come back into Jersey. That's how they get all of them, and rightly so, because they're keeping us safe. Now, this one is I can our last one, the movie E.T. is released. It sells 14 million copies, pre-sold.
Yeah, it was because it was a long time for that movie to. It was 6 years before that film came out on VHS.
Unedited.
Yeah, the original version. And yeah, it was released on video in 1988 and pre-sold 14 million copies, as you say, which is pretty impressive.
Now we're going to get to the real reason why we're here is that start of the summer, May 13th, 1988, we have Friday the 13th, Part 7, A New Blood comes out. And here's a little clip.
Friday, May 13th. It's Jason versus Tina.
Don't go in there!
The match made in hell.
There goes the neighborhood.
Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood, rated R. Starts Friday, May 13th at a theater near you.
They are not the most popular of movies in this series. They really didn't know what to do with it.
No. I mean, because initially it was supposed to be a Freddy versus Jason movie, but they couldn't get any of the... They couldn't get it off the ground, you know, because of Paramount and New Line and all that kind of stuff. It never really happened. And so they decided to bring in this kind of almost like Carrie ripoff, which was Tina. Tina has these psychic abilities, and years prior, she's accidentally killed her father. She drowned him, didn't she, I think, by accident?
Yeah, on the dock, you know, she made it. I don't know if he drowned or was killed when the dock collapsed.
Mm.
But yeah, it was a weird opening. We never had really a flashback opening except for maybe Part 5 with Tommy, you know, going back to Jason being dug up. But other than that, we never had a flashback.
I mean, the good thing about this, it has a few positives. I mean, one of the good things about it is, you know, John Carl Beekler, who was an effects artist who did, he did effects on a lot of the 80s horror films. He'd done a movie called Prison, which came out the year before, and Kane Hodder was in that film. And he was so impressed with the way he kind of handled himself in that film, particularly the sequence where he ate live worms or something. I can't remember. Yeah. I've seen the film a long
audition,
time ago. Yeah. And he ate some. And Beekler was really impressed with this and fought with Paramount to get him to play Jason Voorhees, which if he hadn't have done, it would have been C.J. Graham. He was still up for the role from Part 6. But yeah, Beekler he knew what to do in terms of effects work. And so, in my opinion, what you have is, I think, the best looking Jason throughout the whole franchise.
It's weird because when he's unmasked finally, this always is a problem with me. His eyes from infancy, because we never seen him from infancy, but, you know, but I mean, from when we first see Jason, you know, when Ari played him coming out of the water and, you see his eye go back to normal. It moves back to the original spot.
It's gone back up, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's just like, you know, it slides down throughout each movie to go back to normal position.
Yeah. And then I think further on in the franchise, it's back down there, isn't it? I think in maybe Jason Takes Manhattan or something like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Beekler had done some incredible effects work on this film. And, you know, the MPAA butchered the hell out of it. They cut it to, they made them cut it to within an inch of its life.
There was a lot of carnage.
And so what we end up with is a really kind of sanitized version of Friday the 13th. And the really sad thing is, as well, is that Paramount, just those bits that were cut out, they didn't hang on to them at all. They just thrown them away. Yeah, yeah. So there are huge parts of this movie that could that would quite possibly make a really interesting director's cut that are just gone forever. And it was one of those things that Beekler had a real bee in his bonnet about and just wouldn't. Every time he was interviewed, he would mention it. And, you know, I know fans have campaigned for a long time to see his original vision, and it's just never going to happen at all. And bless him, he's died now. You know, he died a couple of years ago, and that film's we're stuck with it, the version that we have, unfortunately. There are bits now and again that pop up, but yeah, the original version of that film will never be seen.
Well, there's pictures of the father coming up at the end. He's more gnarly. He's more like undead, and it's a shame because every time I read about, you know, possibly new footage, I always think of Event Horizon, you know, seeing blood orgy scene, and you're like, it's gone. It's fucking gone. They say it's gone. It's gone. Because maybe the extra footage of this movie is in the salt mine in Transylvania.
Quite possibly.
But it was a movie that was quickly filmed, but it did set the longest record for a fire. When Kane went on fire, it was one of the longest Hollywood-controlled, uninterrupted on-screen fires in Hollywood history.
And that must have been really tough for him as well, because, you know, we all know Kane Hodder's kind of badly burnt himself from an accident that happened in the late 70s, I think it was, or early 80s. I can't quite remember when it was now. But yeah, he had a terrible accident and was burnt really badly and suffered a lot of pain, and almost to the point where he was going to kill himself.
Yeah.
You know, the doctors who were operating on him with burn damage that he had fucked it all up and made it even worse. And so actually going into doing this stunt, which involved him being set on fire for 40 seconds, which is a hell of a long time, must have been really daunting for the poor bloke.
Yeah, there's a documentary about him, he actually said that he scared a little girl of the way he looked, and that's what really sent him over the edge. But then he found a good burn unit that would help him, and now he's not really, you don't really see the scars so much. I mean, if you look and stare at him, you could, but he looks just like a normal guy. You know, all 6'2" of him. But you know,
6'2".
But either though, it was just thrown together. The box office receipts don't lie.
No, it did okay for the budget that it had. I mean, it was a $2.8 million budget and did just under $20 million. So you know, it's not bad at all. I don't think it's the worst in the franchise.
Nope.
So it was, I guess the summer was fairly cool for Friday the 13th Part 7, The New Blood, given that it was, what are we now, 33 years ago? Jesus, 33 years ago. Rotten Tomatoes were, you know, not the worst in the series. Again, it was 32%. But it's not one of the fan favorites. I think if people saw the original cut, maybe they would feel slightly differently, because it does feel like a really sanitized version of a Friday the 13th film. And we'd all love to see that kind of, is it the Bushmaster 5000 scene?
Yes.
That kind of hedge trimmer that he slams into that guy's stomach and it just kind of cuts away. I think everybody's been waiting for years to see that sequence, but doesn't look like it's going to happen. There is one thing as well that I learned today that I never realized, or perhaps I did at the time and I've forgotten about it, was that Walt Gorney, who played Crazy Ralph, does the narration at the start of the movie for this. And it was the last thing that he did, I think. It was his final role before he died.
It would have been nice if he said, "You're all doomed," at the end. Yeah. Then people would have caught on to him. Oh my God, that's him. but you know what, we're going from one maniac to another on the same day. And this is probably now a cult favorite of a lot of people once they see it. And that's, you have Tom Atkins in it, you have Bruce Campbell in it, you have Robert Zadar. Everybody with a lot of chins is in this movie. And that's Maniac Cop.
You really think a cop did this? Why not?
Why does Jack keep killing people?
He'll kill again. He enjoys killing.
When the most terrifying man in the city carries a badge,
I'm gonna read you your rights.
You have the right to remain silent.
I know who committed these murders.
Forever.
He's back. Only now he kills innocent people.
Maniac Cop, rated R.
Darren, Maniac Cop. It's an 80s cult icon almost.
Yeah. William Lustig directed it, and he'd done a kind of really sleazy, horrible kind of slasher, I guess, in the early 80s, which was on the kind of the blacklist in the UK under the title of a video nasty, and it was called Maniac.
Name your next title, Maniac. cop.
And he coughs up this idea of Maniac Cop. There's a lot of things I really like about this film. I do, you know, remember my, you know, youth reading Fangoria magazine and looking forward to this. Maniac, I like the introduction where old Robert Zadar's getting ready and prepping all his outfit and everything. I love the fact that Atkins is in it. It's not Atkins' best role.
Stash Atkins.
It's Stash Atkins as well. It's not his best role, and also kind of disappointingly, given that this became a franchise, he's the star of the film, but ends up getting killed about two-thirds of the way through, which I think was a huge mistake. Nobody kills Atkins.
And then Bruce Campbell jumps in, even though he's not in the whole movie. He's more towards the end.
Yeah. It's the flow of it's quite odd. But no, I can't believe Atkins got killed in this. Atkins has got things to do.
He's got to go leave his wife to bang younger girls.
Yes.
Well, that's probably why it only took 3 days to film this fucker. Because Tom was like, listen, I got to get laid. I'm going. I got to get out of here.
There's arses to slap and things like that. It killed him off.
Yeah. It's like, oh, well, Tom, you going to stay through the whole movie? No, I got to get laid. Kill me. I got to go. I got to go. I got boys to slap as well.
And beers to drink.
Beers to drink. It's funny because Robert was actually a Chicago police officer. So he had, I guess, some experience in this role, of course.
Yeah.
You know, Sam Raimi was connected to it. He actually filmed some of the New York St. Paddy's Day parade, and that's how they got some investors because they thought he was attached to it. But I mean, what do you think of the movie as a whole? I mean, I think it's a good movie. I think it has a good. I think they want to bring this back. Actually, I think they want to do a series.
It's been mentioned a few times over the last kind of 20 years or so, hasn't it? Because they did three, didn't they? I've seen the first two. I don't think I ever saw the third one. I mean, because in this he gets skewered. He gets skewered and goes down to the bottom of the Hudson, doesn't he?
With Bruce Campbell fucking flying.
That's a great stunt, because that truck at the end, when it kind of goes off the dock, it's within inches of landing on that guy. It's a
and he
great
pops back
stunt,
up out of the water. You're like, oh my god, he did it! God.
What I do like is there's a sequence where Lauren Landon, the blonde policewoman, who's kind of like undercover as a hooker. There's a bit where she's kind of on the edge of a building, kind of jumping off ledges and things like that, and it's clearly just some big guy in a big blonde wig. Big blonde crimped wig.
It's Fabio.
Yeah. Jeez. It looked like fucking D. Snyder.
What a rock! Well, you know what? Even though we enjoyed this movie, it didn't do too well. It was kind of a blunder at the box office.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's had a life, obviously. I mean, like you say, there's a trilogy of these films. And I actually think Maniac Cop 2 is slightly better than the first one as well, isn't it? But
it has Bud in it.
It does. It does. It has Bud. 50% on Rotten Tomatoes. 1.1 million budget. And 671K at the box office. So just over $500,000 it made. So it was I don't know what on earth made them do a sequel to this. It must have done incredibly well on VHS. That's all I can imagine.
The poster is fantastic.
It is. It's you know what? This movie has, it's fun. It is fun.
And then that music, which is basically just somebody whistling, is creepy as hell too.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. Part two is actually slightly better.
Yeah.
And actually, I've said that on our previous shows where sequels were better than the originals.
Maniac Cop 2.
But from one knife to another, and almost I guess 2 weeks later, a little under 2 weeks later, we get this iconic character.
On the floor.
Paul Hogan is Michael J. Crocodile Dundee.
Hey! Hi, Sarge.
I might have known it would be you.
Is this New York fish, Sarge? I want to take a bite.
Crocodile Dundee 2.
May 25th, we see the release of Crocodile Dundee Part 2, though. We don't get the first one. That came out, I think, later on, I think before the summer began. But I am a huge Crocodile Dundee fan. I actually think Crocodile Dundee is actually better than Indiana Jones as a character.
Say that again.
I think Crocodile Dundee is actually better than Indiana Jones as a character.
Really?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
I'm speechless now. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the last ever episode of the Slaughter Lamb Movie Podcast.
If there was a fight between Indiana Jones and Crocodile Dundee, Crocodile Dundee would probably win. And I think he's a better character.
Okay.
Okay, let's continue before you take the piss out of me. But this movie was actually... The whole series was actually based on a real guy who actually, I guess his name was Rod Ansell. He was down in Australia, of course, and his boat capsized, and he's actually basically fighting for his life, you know, wrestling and fighting and kicking ass a crocodile. That's what my research has shown.
That's the kind of backstory you get in the first film, isn't it? Which the first film is fantastic. It's a superb kind of, you know, 80s was full of fish out of water stories, and this is the kind of ultimate one, was Crocodile Dundee. I remember going to London with my granddad, and we saw it in a cinema in London in the early 80s. And the whole film's just like one big kind of long, warm hug. You just feel so great when you've seen that film. It really was something quite special, I thought. Mm-hmm. The sequel is still fun. It feels more like an action film than it does the comedy that the original one was. And yeah, the reviewers really turned against it. I mean, they gave it 10%. It's 10% on Rotten Tomatoes is the second one, which I think is really, I think that's really harsh. The movie cost $14 million and made $240 million. So that tells you everything you need to know in terms of what people thought of it. It's not as good as the original, but still, it's a decent fun little movie.
Yeah,
but I don't know about it being better than Indiana Jones.
As a character, not as a movie, as a character.
Okay.
Let's not beat me up too much.
I'll leave that to people in the comments down below. They'll do.
Go ahead and comment, goddamn. I don't give a shit. So yeah, but you know what? It was nice to see. You know, you took Crocodile Dundee out of his element. and he kind of was okay in New York. He kind of was able to maneuver himself around, make some friends, and they all liked him because he is this charismatic and honest guy who could certainly take care of himself, definitely on the street of New York. But then when, of course, Sue gets kidnapped, you know, his real wife, real life wife, Linda, whose ass was missing from this show, from this movie this time. Another jog shuttle moment, rewind that I had. And then he went back to Australia in the outback. It felt better because he was in his element and he was the king of that whole landscape and could, you know, basically screw around with the captors and the drug dealers that were going after him. It felt good.
Yeah, yeah. This is where he's most comfortable.
I still like that line, you know, they have Wally as a hostage. You know, they're telling him, you know, come down or we'll kill him. And he's thinking, and he goes, shoot the dopey bastard. Because the only way he can save his life is by thinking that he wants him dead too.
Yeah.
Because he thinks Wally's going to show him all the secrets. But... yeah, Crocodile Dundee, you know, Man with a Big Knife, part two. And on the same day, this movie did about $100 million less, which is amazing. Another man carrying a big knife, and that's Sly Stallone in Rambo 3.
What do you think this man is?
God!
Oh, God, would have mercy. He was.
He's a soldier who never draws first blood. But they forced him back to save his only friend.
Why must you do this?
Because he did it for me.
Stallone is back in Rambo 3.
Who are you?
Worst nightmare.
Rated R.
Yeah, another movie that was, I think it was kind of rushed, right? They kind of just threw a story in there. It was another, you know, going up against another Russian.
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know, at the time, I thought it was like the weakest one of the series. It's certainly the slowest burn. Russell Mulcahy, the director of Highlander, he was originally the director of this film and spent a few weeks shooting, but had some sort of disagreement and walked off set. And, you know, there are still parts of what he did in the movie. Not much, but there's still some of it there. And they brought in a director called Peter McDonald, who I think had been mainly a producer before.
Yeah, and he was also second unit on this.
Yeah. And he came in and I would imagine, to be completely honest, he was just a kind of whipping boy for Stallone. I reckon that Stallone probably took the reins on this and he, you know, was Peter McDonald was doing everything he said, basically. But yeah, it's a... he gets called in to go and rescue Colonel Troutman, who's been who's kind of been caught up behind enemy lines in Afghanistan during the actual period of time when the Russians were invading. And it's interesting that the director, Peter McDonald, cites the fact that the Russians pulled out of Afghanistan a few weeks before the movie was released. He cites that as being one of the reasons why it wasn't as successful as the other Rambo films, which I don't believe that for one minute. You know what I mean? I don't think people will give a shit who Rambo's fighting.
No.
I think it was just the fact that the whole thing was probably a little bit tired by then, and people had moved on a little bit to sort of just to Schwarzenegger's films. But yeah, it's it has some great. I mean, the scale of it is incredible. You know, but also absolutely ludicrous at the same time. You know, there's that scene where just Rambo and Troutman are up against the whole of the bloody Russian army, and great big gunships and helicopters and everything, and they take them on. There's literally like hundreds of them all there.
Yep.
After First Blood, which is an incredible movie, and Rambo, which was a great bit of popcorn cheese, this didn't hit the mark for a lot of people, I don't think.
No, you know, and a lot of it, you know, they had three editors on this trying to meet the deadline. As soon as they were working, one person would take a cut, they would give it to them, and they would edit it, and three of them doing it. Okay, I'm still editing this one scene, give it to the next guy. I mean, there are movies that have that many editors on it, correct? If it's a big scale movie, you can't just give it all to one guy.
No, of course. Yeah. No, that will happen for sure.
And of course, Stallone, being who he is, he did his own stunts. really in this movie. He was riding his own horse, you know, and that one part, that looks grueling going after
when
that
they're playing
dead
that
lamb.
Of, yeah, it's like a, it's almost like a sort of
football like game or
urban polo game or something like that. It's just, yeah, it looks pretty rough, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, interestingly, one of the things that I picked up on today was that the main villain, Colonel Zaysen, Carolco originally wanted Brando to play him.
Oh, Christ's sake.
And Brando actually did some revisions on the scripts. And so he actually kind of probably made it all about himself and everything, and probably Rambo died and all that. But yeah, Brando reworked the script and everything, and then eventually they chose not to have him in the film at all. But yeah, that would have been a kind of interesting idea
like a,
to watch.
Like a revisit to Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, it did. It really underperformed in the US, just $55 million in the US. Yeah. Around about and then 102 million overseas. It performed a lot better internationally and kind of cemented his status as a kind of global superstar. But yeah, at that point North America was starting to kind of go off the boil with Stallone, as kind of Schwarzenegger was sort of, you know, coming up in his slipstream.
It's funny because it, like I said before with Dundee, that sequel did better than this one.
Yeah.
Because it just came out the right time. I think it probably took, you know, $100 million away from it easily.
Awesome. I mean, there's a lot of things to consider around that time. You've got, you know, on the next film we're going to talk about was kind of in the way as well. Big was out in the cinemas as well. So, you know, that would have taken up a lot of screen space. So I just think that ultimately, I think just people were really tiring of Stallone at that point. And one other thing that we picked up on as well today is that there's no women in the film at all.
No.
There's no female roles whatsoever in this film.
They're
apart
only
from a few extras.
Exactly. I was about to say that. The ones that are running away from the helicopter assault.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but, you know, I think people were getting, like you said, they were getting tired of, like you said, that Stallone Schwarzenegger action movie, and the next example is rightly so just that, because on June 17th Red Heat comes out starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jim Belushi.
I'm Ivan Danko, Moscow Special Police. I'm here to track down dangerous Soviet criminal. A Chicago police officer is helping me.
A Chicago cop never relinquishes his weapon. Here.
Now I know why we invented vodka.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, James Belushi, Red Heat.
You know, let's get it right off the bat. It's not a bad movie. It was 67% on Rotten Tomatoes with a budget of $29 million, making $34 million at the box office. Kind of didn't do that good. But, directed and written by Walter Hill.
Yeah, but also really similar to another film that he did kind of 8 years before, or was it 8 years or 6 years before? 48 Hours. Mm-hmm. It's a really, really similar concept, you know, two kind of misfits pairing up and partnering to track down a killer, basically. I mean, Schwarzenegger plays this character, Ivan Danko, who's this Soviet police officer.
Didn't he box later? We'll box Rocky later, Ivan Danko.
Yeah, that's him.
Jesus,
he's in Creed 2 as well. Yeah. Schwarzenegger comes to Chicago to track down a Georgian drug kingpin that's got away from him in Russia, and he partners with Ritsek, is it? I think Jim Belushi's character's called, to track him down. He's in Chicago somewhere, and it's just the same kind of buddy-buddy cop movie that we've seen 1,000 times before, but it's a fun one. You know, there's some great quipping, there's some great moments between the two of them as they have this kind of love-hate relationship as the film kind of goes on. They kind of understand each other a little bit more, but yeah, it was nothing new, And so it just didn't quite work at the box office. And I think, I don't know, whether people were just tiring of action films at that point.
I think so. This thing was loaded with action. You got the bus chase scene because Arnold couldn't fit in a car for a chase scene. They used the bus, which I think adds a little bit more, you know, dynamic to it. Schwarzenegger was actually slimmer to his previous movies. And, you know, and Jim was actually bulking up because they, relatively to their size, Jim is actually quite small.
Yeah.
So they ordered him to, you know, bulk up to match it. But it has one of your favorite lines in it, doesn't it? Cocaine.
When he rips the guy's leg off.
Yeah.
He rips the guy's fake leg off in that bar and just holds it up, shakes the coke out of the fake leg and shouts, cocaine.
Which actually, he read that part and they actually said, oh, you're perfect for this. you know, but it was the bathhouse scene in the beginning. It was actually shot in two different countries. I think Austria and Hungary, exterior and interior. But unfortunately, the stuntman in that bathhouse died. He had a heart attack filming one of the scenes.
Yeah, I think the movie's dedicated to him as well, isn't it?
Yep. And one of the first Hollywood movies, though, that was actually allowed to film in Moscow's Red Square.
Yeah. At a time when we actually got on with those guys for a while.
We were actually becoming a little bit of friends, you know. But like we said, it didn't do too well at the box office. But it has another life, just like most Schwarzenegger movies, except for Batman and Robin.
Yeah, I don't mind watching it now and again if it's on. There are some really, like, say,
what, Batman and Robin?
No, not that thing. You almost sunk this channel talking about Mr. Freeze last week. Folks, I woke up after Frank had spoken about Mr. Freeze and we lost about 8 subscribers.
And it was the Schwarzenegger version and in that movie, not the actual character. And that's what I'm trying to mean. And it's Darren's own fault because he put up Schwarzenegger.
I did a thumbnail with Schwarzenegger on it and quickly took it down after we was slowly losing all our subscribers. Anyway,
we digress.
Red Heat, as you said, it did 34 million at the box office, 29 million budget, 67% on Rotten Tomatoes. So the critics kind of liked it, but the summer was cruel to it, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously lost a lot of money, and we never saw another film. You know, it was the kind of movie that would have possibly made, that you would have got a sequel to. And there was talk about a sequel kind of doing it in reverse, a bit like what they did with Crocodile Dundee, whereas Ritsek goes over to Moscow to partner with Arnie on a case over there. Now, that would have been interesting, seeing that kind of, you know. Yeah, it sounds like another Rush Hour, doesn't it?
So, you know, let's get away from action, because on that same day, on June 17th, we have a Dan Aykroyd and John Candy classic, and that's The Great Outdoors.
Dan Aykroyd and John Candy are headed for the great outdoors.
We weren't invited.
They'll be tickled to death to see us.
But this is no holiday.
Who invited them anyway?
This is war. The Great Outdoors. Outdoor fun for everyone. Rated PG. Starts Friday, June 17th at theaters everywhere.
Darren, I love The Great Outdoors. I think it's one of their best movies.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan at all. I'm not a fan. I know that a lot of people are going to be spitting at me for this, but the movie never... I've been trying to find out today. I've been asking friends and I've been looking at some records that I have. And I'm convinced it never even got a theatrical release in this country. Because it's the sort of thing that I would have gone to see. Mm-hmm. And I only watched it for the first time kind of about 5 or 6 years ago. And I think it's okay. But I don't get what all the fuss is about. I know, like, Dave cites it as one of his favorite John Candy films. But I just don't get it at all. I love the two leads, but I just don't think it's that funny.
You'd rather choose Stripes.
Yeah, I prefer stripes. Seriously.
You know what? But a lot of people kind of agreed with you because 44% Rotten Tomatoes, $24 million budget, 43. It made its money back and probably a little bit more. But you know what? It was Bart the Bear. He was a staple in movies with bears. It had the talking raccoons. You know, I'm an animal guy, so I could appreciate, you know, all those raccoons going around and saying, oh, they're putting cinder blocks on garbage cans. What do they think we are, dumb? Ooh, they're from Chicago. We're going to be eating good tonight. The bat flying around and everything, and then they shoot the ass out of the bear. What did you think, you know, one of your favorite parts, you know, if even though you don't like the movie so much, what about the old 96er part? Where he's eating the 96, the steak, the 90...
The steak, yeah, yeah.
96-ounce steak.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny, I guess. I struggle with this film. I really do. It's not, you know, that kind of setting, that kind of, I guess, vacation is not something that we do over here. And so it was difficult for me to relate to.
Well, isn't it true that the Brits as a whole hate camping?
Yeah, because the weather's always shit here. So if we camp, we would do it in another country or something where you're guaranteed good weather. Some people like it. I mean, if camping, you're talking about camping in a tent, or are you talking about just camping in a lodge or a caravan or a...
Either or. I think it's just, you know, I think taking your trailer, hooking it up to a lorry and moving this to a campsite and just sitting there and staring at each other is pretty dull to the Brits.
Yeah, it is. I think the Brits kind of, they base their holidays around where the nearest pubs are and restaurants and things like that.
And going to France.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, that holidaying to us is sunning yourself in the day and then getting drunk in the evening. That's it.
And trying to find your way home later.
Exactly. Not running away for your life from a fucking great bear.
with a bare ass and a bald head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But we can't lose faith because it looks like we're all getting cruel in the start of the summer, because next on June 22nd, one of the biggest movies of that year and practically for that decade came out, and that's Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Pictures invites you to tune in again for the most highly acclaimed movie of the year.
He's here.
Tune in again for Roger Rabbit, Jessica Rabbit, Baby Herman, Benny the Calf, and the most incredible cast of tunes ever to perform together in one motion picture.
What's up, Doc?
My biscuits are burning!
This is hot stuff!
Tune in again for Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
The last time I worked with someone with a speech impediment.
A Steven Spielberg presentation, a Robert Zemeckis film, rated PG. Now playing at a theater near you. Check newspaper for showtimes.
Darren, I saw this in the theater as a kid, and I was awed by Roger Rabbit, how they can put real life people mixed with some of my cartoon heroes. Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse were on there. It was a collaboration of studios that made this movie possible.
Yeah, I don't know how they managed to do it. How do you get Disney to hand over all their toon characters and Warner Brothers and throw them in a blender? I don't know how that all came about. It must have taken a act of God to get those two studios to work together. And New Line and Paramount couldn't get two characters on screen together in Freddy and Jason. They had everybody in the mix in this film. And you know, obviously with the might of the likes of Robert Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg behind it, Jeffrey Katzenberg as well, and Michael Eisner, and just, you know, so many like Hollywood bigwigs throwing their weight around to get this film made. And the list of who they wanted in the cast, and it's the usual suspects, do you know what I mean? But there's some really interesting kind of... Bob Hoskins wouldn't have been anybody's first choice for this role, but he was perfect for it. But, you know, they'd gone down the list of people like Eddie Murphy and Harrison Ford and there was all sorts of people. Paul Rubens was up for the role of Roger Rabbit, and... Tim Curry was going to be an audition to be Judge Doom, and apparently Spielberg sat down and just thought he was fucking terrifying.
Because you know what? He didn't blink. He doesn't blink. Christopher Lloyd does not blink.
No,
he just stares at you, and you're just like, Jesus Christ.
Robin Williams would have been quite fun as Judge Doom as well. He was another one that would that was considered for it. But the movie, I mean, I watched it again this morning, and it's so smart. It really is. Interesting, though, that they did a test screening of it, and they tested it to a bunch of, why on earth they did this, I don't know, because it was kind of, I see it more as a family film. They tested it to 18, 19-year-olds, and they all hated it.
It's not meant for them. It's meant for, you know, kids that were like us, like growing up.
And their parents.
Pre-puberty kids and their parents.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's 140 pre-existing cartoon characters. Going on throughout that whole movie, and plus at the end when they all come together, some of them the young kids would know, and the older parents would say, "Oh my God, look who it is! It's Baby Huey, you know, and everything like that." The teenagers are not going to know who they are.
The kind of characters in that film sort of transcend generations, don't they? They go right back to the early days of Disney and Warner Brothers. And apparently, Robert Zemeckis was sat in an auditorium at this preview. And there was a guy that was sat in front of him, turned to his girlfriend when it finished and said, "It's just like Howard the Duck."
Oh, no.
Or Howard, A New Breed of Hero, as it was called in the US. It was called Howard the Duck in the UK. Because we had no idea what that thing was. But yeah, the studio, Disney wanted to... or Touchstone, I think it was, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Wanted to make some serious edits on it. And Zemeckis stood his ground and said, "No, I don't believe that that audience are right." And he was right. He had final cut, final say, and that's the movie that we got.
There's a couple scenes in there where you see the dueling pianos with Daffy and Donald is fantastic. Yeah. It's great. They're all beating the shit out of each other. And then towards the end, when you see Mickey and Bugs come together and they're flying or they're falling through the sky, you know, and they give the spare, which is, you know, just a tire. It was good to see that collaboration. There was one part for me that was absolutely gut wrenching. And that's when Judge actually takes his dip and he dips the poor, helpless shoe in it.
Yeah, that's
oh my God. I cried.
There are a few really edgy bits in this like that. There's the bit where the guy who's kind of ends up hanging himself. Mm-hmm. There's the bit with, like you say, the shoe being tortured. And also the bit where Judge Doom gets run over by that steamroller. And it's kind of like, it's on the cusp of being quite a, you know, I think it was borderline, I don't know what the rating was in the US, but it was borderline being shunted up into the next category in some of the sequences, I think.
Well, the original script, if they did it that way, would have been a rated R, because the judge was actually supposed to be, and it was going to be revealed in this movie, to have shot Bambi's mother.
Really? Oh, I didn't know that.
Could you imagine the heat Christopher Lloyd would have gotten?
Yeah,
they
exactly.
Said,
yeah,
you killed, because you never see Bambi's the hunter and Bambi.
No, no.
And if they revealed, you know, "Oh, I shot Bambi's mother," and then Jessica Rabbit was actually supposed to be the villain.
Okay,
imagine how twisted it would have been later on, you know, just to find those two out. But
I think you know what's interesting is that the idea of it seemed to really frighten a lot of actors away. I think, you know, Kurt Russell, Harrison Ford, and there was one other actor as well whose name escapes me, but those
Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, probably him. John Belushi.
Sly Stallone.
Apparently Schwarzenegger was down for Judge Doom, but it was at a point where he was probably up for every role anyway.
Yeah.
But I think on paper, I think when it was explained to people that you're going to be acting to nothing, I think a lot of major Hollywood talent just walked away and said, "I don't want anything to do with that." But since then, they've all regretted it. Bill Murray, who famously nobody can get hold of him, Spielberg tried for weeks to try and get hold of him to star as Eddie Valiant in this. Mm-hmm. and no one could track down Bill Murray. And then years later, when he admitted that he, if they'd have got hold of him, he would have definitely accepted that role. But what, every time I watch, the only problem for me with this film is, which is Bob Hoskins. I can never get Bob Hoskins' performance in The Long Good Friday out of my head as Harold Shand. And I always wanted bits of Harold Shand to come out when...
do some whacking.
Yeah, in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Tombs of Shittim.
Yeah. Jesus. Well, it's a good thing it wasn't in there or the way you wanted it, because 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. Definitely cool for the summer of 1988. $70 million. Quite expensive. Quite expensive. Mm-hmm. But it did $329 million at the box office. So it got its money back. It made a character that everybody now... I think Disney now owns Roger Rabbit. But yeah, it's. I think it's on everybody's shelf.
The dog pisses on his grave, and so he comes back to... A dog pisses fire on his grave, and so he comes back to life.